What kind of home have you got to live in? And if you design a home that is not as a refuge, but there as a place to be able to think, it's a slightly different concept. I'm not going to hide you in this secondary container, but I am going to help you to think in this secondary container. Then I think it feels easier to turn to colleagues and be open to them and get help. Whereas if you think that colleagues are going to be making judgments about you in this more paranoid, schizoid way, then it's not a safe place to go. And then you become stuck. And I think you probably become stuck doing things that otherwise you would not have done.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Philip Stocco. Philip Stocco is a psychoanalyst in private practice in London, where he works with adults and couples, and he's also an organizational consultant with a great deal of experience with groups working at Tavistock and providing consultation to a wide range of organizations. We cover a lot of territory in our conversation today. It's really, I found it quite invigorating and delightful. We start talking about the confusion of tongues, if you will, between technical and common sense language as it applies to clinical work. We use as examples the notion of resistance and boundaries, which is something that Philip has studied extensively in his work in groups. And we talk a lot about his appreciation of curiosity. That's what his book is about, published by Phoenix Publishing. It's The Curiosity Drive. And he traces the development of curiosity from early on with family encouragement to be interested in frustration and how to imagine in the face of frustration and how that helps one develop the capacity to be creative, to be uncertain, and to stay with the theme, with curiosity. We discuss that as it applies to the clinical situation and the importance of boundaries, both boundaries in terms of what they limit and also what they create, what the two individuals in a boundaried situation are able to create at the edges of the boundaries. Philip has a great deal to say about that. He also speaks with us about his notion of a secondary container. It is not just the two individuals in a room that are creating meaning. It's also the relationship of the clinician to the environment that they're in, whether it be an institute or whether it be the licensing agency that governs their work. It's quite a wide-ranging conversation. He's a very thoughtful man that has a lot to say about our work. And he's also quite open about his own childhood situations and how it contributed to his interest in organizations, ethics, boundaries, and certainly curiosity. Here's my conversation with Philip Stocco. Philip, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here.
Thanks, Harvey.
Philip, there are certain psychoanalytic terms that borrow from the common sense English lexicon. And I think we borrow from the common sense world to our disadvantage. And there are two terms that come to my mind about that. The first is the term resistance. Now, everybody knows outside of our field in a straightforward way what resistance means and what it conjures up. It conjures up an image of a resistor and a resistee. It suggests that there are forces pressing between the two of them. It suggests some effort to try to overcome resistance. And all too often, you will hear that lay notion brought to psychoanalytic discourse. It's often said that the patient is resisting, with the clear implication that the analyst should do something to make it go away and, you know, bring force to bear on it. And we know that, in fact, resistance is not that. My own personal way of thinking of the term resistance, an unfortunate term, is that it's the best way at any particular moment that a patient knows how to bring all of themselves to this moment. It represents, if you will, a compromise formation of various factors of external reality, of internal longing, of conflicted disappointment, of transference fantasies, of fears and hopes. It's a whole conglomeration in a moment that people loosely call resistance, but it's our job to try to understand all the factors that are leading the patient to this moment so that we can help them understand it cognitively and, more importantly, help them experience it affectively so they can develop the freedoms and the plasticity so that they can deal with these moments in a variety of ways that give them more satisfaction in life. So that's an example in my mind of how resistance is often misunderstood. Another term that I think falls in that category is the term boundaries. It's certainly an everyday term that people use, again, outside of the field. It conjures up, like resistance, a very binary way of thinking, that there is a sharp line to boundaries. There's one side of a boundary. There's another side of a boundary. We know wars have been fought over boundaries. And I think you have written really elegantly about your understanding of the psychoanalytic approach to boundaries, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the way you get to it and the way you get to understanding things like resistance and, in fact, the whole psychoanalytic enterprise is through your notion of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you've written a whole book on it that I have right here. It's called The Curiosity Drive, Our Need for Inquisitive Thinking, published by Phoenix Publishing House in 2020. And by curiosity, you're not simply referring to what's quite familiar in the analytic world, which is Oedipal level conflicted taboo curiosity about sexuality. You're referring to something earlier than that. So why don't you start us off? Tell us about your sense of curiosity, and that'll work us forward to these other notions.
Good. Thank you. By the way, I love that description of resistance. I completely agree with you. I haven't heard it described in quite that way before, and it seems to me to be exactly what happens, because I believe that the arrangement between patient and therapist is a sort of unconscious contract, and it works. When the two come together in the consulting room, there really is, on both sides, focus on the thing that brought the patient there in the first place. So I think it's a lovely way of putting it. So thank you for that. I'm going to use it and steal it. It's very
please,
good.
Please feel free. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So curiosity. I suppose what I would say is that there are a number of ways of approaching this, and so I'm just going to do it in terms of thinking about a discomfort I had for some time with Freud's idea of why the baby turns to face reality. I think his description of the pleasure principle, which is based, as we know, on the idea that the way that human beings and all animals behave is controlled by drives, which I think Mark Solms frequently uses the expression urge to kind of make alive this sense of a drive. And he ends up, Freud that is, with the idea that there are essentially two main drives, which are sort of collections of other drives, but essentially two main ones, which later on Bion put as being love and hate. And I'm going to use those concepts because my thinking about curiosity derives from the next thing that Bion did, which was to add K, the urge for knowledge, to it. But the thing for me that changes the way that I think about the development of the mind and so on is that in my experience, animals get on pretty well with the pleasure principle. There's no sense that they, as Freud described it, hallucinate the breast and then as a way of tolerating the absence of the breast. And then when the hallucination disappears, they then suddenly feel the urge to face reality. I mean, they don't. They just wander off and find another way of managing getting rid of the unpleasure of hunger. So what is it? There has to be something that accounts for why the human being turns to face reality. And I think the thought about there being a third innate drive, a drive that functions in the same way as love and hate, that requires us, as it were, constantly to explain to ourselves what's going on here. That's just a way of putting it. Obviously, it isn't quite like that. I think it's much more a sort of urge to know, to understand. But it ends up being what's going on here. That, if it's functioning from the beginning, would be something that would cause the infant to say, well, you know, that hallucination didn't work. Let's look again at what's really going on here. And so it would be that is essential to the view, the turning towards reality. And I think when we have that connection, that curiosity is the key to the reality principle, then everything else changes subtly, but very interestingly. And for instance, the role of the mother becomes really important in encouraging the baby to build on this early curiosity drive. Bion described a kind of prototype of thinking as being, he called it alpha function. And I think, from my point of view, that is exactly this earliest process of the curiosity drive, creating explanations for what's going on here that then build into the conscious mind. All of those explanations develop in the light of experience. Of course, they change so that, for instance, when my daughter was taken to the local lake by her grandmother, on one occasion there was a duck came out of the pond and waddled towards them, and Grandma says duck, and Willow goes, oh, duck. The next day they go back again and there is an old lady coming towards them who sadly waddles as she walks, and Willow goes, duck. But of course it isn't. And so fortunately, you'll be relieved to know that she did adapt her understanding of duck and so built a different layer as she developed her conscious mind. Of course, the problem is, and this links, I think, a lot to resistance and the work, the focus of the work, the problem is that sometimes we don't change our explanations in the light of new experience. And that is because whatever it is that we're experiencing is so difficult for us. So we become stuck with what Britton would call an unconscious belief. And the unconscious belief remains fixed. And that becomes the problem later on in relating. At first, it may be very helpful in the child's life, but in the adult's life, it becomes a problem, and that might bring the adult to therapy. And then the therapist is going to be trying to understand and explore the unconscious belief.
And part of what makes it problematic is that they don't know that they have this fixed belief.
Absolutely right. That because it's unconscious, they don't know they have it. And so the business of the exploration, and obviously I'm very taken by your thing about resistance, the business of the struggle is that the patient brings this unconscious belief, as exactly as you said, because that is what needs to be looked at. But of course, they don't want to give it up because it is attached to the idea that giving it up is dangerous. I mean, it was created in order to protect the patient, so giving it up is dangerous. And so the analyst finds themselves in a relationship to this aspect of the patient in which they are either being drawn into confronting it or else feeling that they want to give up confronting it. So, and I know we're going to talk about boundaries in a minute, but you can see that we're already in an area where investigation requires a movement across what otherwise might be taken to be a boundary. And just one last thing to say about the development of curiosity. It seems to me that the thing that makes for good enough mothering or caring isn't getting an answer. In fact, quite the opposite. I think it's often very disturbing when you meet a mother who goes straight away to say, well, you're tired, you're hungry, or whatever. What is so important is the struggle of not knowing that mother goes through. Because that is the direct experience the baby has of somebody else's curiosity drive, somebody else's alpha function, that they stay with it. They don't give up being curious. They remain interested. And then gradually they come to an understanding which they share with the baby.
You've added a new dimension, and you've written about this as well, that a new quality of good enough mothering is that it engages the infant's and child's curiosity.
Yeah. That's
which,
the point.
Which might later also hold as part of a good analysis, engages the self-analytic function. The analyst doesn't necessarily provide answers, but helps the analyst's mind develop so that they can listen to themselves and be curious about their own mind and then potentially other minds as well.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly what we do. And, you know, the other thought that just occurred to me as you said that was Winnicott's focus on play. I was conscious the other day that neuroscience is tending to describe play as a major drive. When I read about it, I realized that I disagree. I think this it's embarrassing to disagree with neuroscientists. They must know what they're talking about. But I do disagree. I think they've misnamed it. What they are observing and calling play, I think, is exploration. The babies who are doing that thing are quite clearly exploring. For me, it is an absolute clear expression of the curiosity drive. And then, of course, when you think about, well, first of all, the way through into play through Winnicott, but then subsequently, the way that we struggle as analysts to describe the process of engaging with somebody's unconscious. And very often we turn to artists because they are much better at describing it. And I think it has the same sense that play has. So that when we're really working well, we are working in a, and I don't mean this in a sort of silly way, but we are playing with the patient. And in the play, I think what you just said is right, that what happens is the patient can feel safe to start to take an interest. And the mistake is, instead of playing, to fall into the trap of becoming insistent.
Yes, that's the certainty the fundamentalist certainty that you write about as part of the paranoid position. But I do want to move us into boundaries, because when I read your book, I came across this paragraph, which I will read only a part of. And I sort of, you know, the feeling you have when you read something and it just hits a spot and you say, wow. I mean, it's a whole variety of things, speaking about a variety of moments. It says, oh, he said that so beautifully. Or, oh, I would like to get to know that man, which is one of the pleasures of these conversations for me. Folded in there somewhere is the feeling of, gee, I wish I could have written that. But even better than all the above, we're going to have a conversation about it, and I'm going to get to share it with our listeners. So this is writing about psychoanalytic rules like boundaries. And you say the following, quote, "They are not things that exist independently of the activities of the working couple. They are part of the engagements of that couple. In fact, they act to stimulate conflict. Perhaps it is truer to say that they are not concrete rules that prescribe the behavior of the participants, as in a legal contract. They are emotional and psychological material that can be stretched and distorted so as to reveal unconscious information. Mm-hmm. The skill of the therapist and the therapeutic institution is to maintain a psychological balance that allows these apparent rules to be broken without ever completely losing the Hippocratic commitment to do no harm." Close quote. You like it too, huh?
Wow.
Yes, I know. All right. So translate that for us. Tell us what you mean.
No. Listen, I think we'll stop there and I'll just go away quietly. Well, maybe the way to pick it up is to go back to when it first began to dawn on me. I mean, you know, these are processes that take years and years and years, but you look back and you see something that was a point at which something changed in your thinking. And this was when I was very young. I was 27, 28, and I was working in something called a youth treatment center, which was designed for the most dangerous adolescents in the country. It was a very interesting experiment. The thought was that although these young people were going to be put into security, that is, locked up like a sort of a prison, they could be in a place where they could get therapy, they could change. There was an idea that these are not children who are going to be stuck like this, and that there could be something done to help them. And that was it, really. They gave us a building and said, you know, it's up to you now. By the way, we think you might be helped by psychoanalytic theories and probably therapeutic community theory. That was it. And then I found myself in this terrible position of being put in charge of one of the therapy units. And in those days, shocking though it may seem, almost everybody smoked. And for some reason, I was one of my first tasks was to try and work out what age I would start to allow kids in the unit to smoke. And I got really stuck, and I spent days and days and days thinking about this. And then a friend of mine said, you know, it really doesn't matter. It's not a right or wrong thing. It can't be right or wrong. And then I realized that I had been trying to find the exact age where there would not be a conflict, where the kids would agree, yeah, that's fair enough, Gov, and the staff would agree, yeah, okay, that's fair enough. And it then dawned on me, this is the thing that was the sort of moment of, good God, I hadn't ever thought of that before. It then dawned on me that actually, if you get the boundary right, then of course there is an opportunity for conflict. It's a safer opportunity than if you don't give boundaries. And remember, these were very violent adolescents. And if they felt that there weren't boundaries, then they would escalate until something became very violent. But if you provide a boundary around which you can then have an encounter, then therapy can take place. And you can start to think about what it is that the child is feeling about the rule. The child is feeling, you're trying to stop me from doing something. And then you can have an engagement about that. And maybe you start to uncover the possibility that actually you're trying to protect them from something. You know, all kinds of things are possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it suddenly changed my way of thinking about boundaries. And then, of course, later on, as I developed my work. And by this stage, I wasn't a psychoanalyst. I was a social worker, and I had just trained as an organizational consultant at the Tavistock Clinic in London. So gradually I began to accumulate other bits of information about boundaries that made me realize that this is where the work happens. And that led me to develop a concept in the youth treatment center, which I then brought with me to therapy and to my therapeutic work in other places, in which it was the design of what I would call a container that provided the place for work to take place safely. And I do, by the way, I need to say, because of course there will be people who think that when I'm talking about boundaries as something, let's say, that are blurred all the time in the work, it may sound as if I'm saying there is always an excuse for a therapist's misbehavior. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the opposite is true, that what we do is we go into the work knowing very, very clearly that our role is rather weird. Our role is very strange. I mean, we're going to avoid bringing our own personality in, and we are going to be focusing entirely on the meaning we can achieve for the patient's behavior. It's a very clear role, and the patient has much more freedom in the sure. arrangement. So it seems to me that the principle is that we will do what we can to ensure that we remain fixed in our role as analyst or therapist. However, the process of inquiry has to be a process that occurs at the boundary. Shall I give you an example of what I mean by that?
Yes, please tell us clinically what that means.
Clinically is quite easy, really, to describe, and it's what I do when I'm teaching about, you know, how do you become a therapist? And so I talked just then about the arrangement, the boundary, and I'm saying that in the arrangement with the patient, and that's, by the way, this thing, this is like a sort of unconscious contract, which links to your description of resistance. So we make an agreement with patients that they can say or do whatever they like, I mean, within reasonable limits. But the point is that they can be free to associate in any way they like. We, on the other hand, are going to remain therapists. And that means we're not going to bring stuff in from the outside, and we are going to try and understand the unconscious meaning. Then we find ourselves being treated as if we're an angry man, for instance. Well, we're not. We're a therapist. So something's happened. The boundary has been broken. I'm being treated as if I'm something that I'm not. Very, very often, of course, I only notice this not so much because of what the patient's doing as because I find myself becoming angry.
Sure.
And then I think, hopefully, I think I notice it and think, what the hell's that? Sometimes I don't notice. Sometimes I am angry. And then I notice that. I mean, fortunately, the point is that we're designing this thing so that we can notice. And then ultimately, of course, we set up systems, which I'll describe in a minute, called the secondary container, which allow us to be picked up when we don't notice it ourselves. But in that moment, when the patient has treated me as an angry man, there is work. But it's on the boundary. I've been turned into something I'm not, and now I can start to do what it is that I've said I will do, which is that I'll try and understand the unconscious meaning of it. So I might say something like, you seem to feel I'm very angry with you. Perhaps that links to your being late for the session, you know, whatever right. it might be. And this sounds very much like you described your father the other day. And then we're doing psychoanalytic work. But the point is, we did that by being pulled across the boundary. And so that means the work, the real work, is at the boundary. If a patient comes into the room and happily starts putting together all of the information that he's learned through all the analysis that he's had, you know, there's very little for the analyst to do. You just sit there and think, oh, that's very interesting. The work happens when that stops. And then you are engaged. Now, of course, the thing about that, it means that the boundary is continually under pressure. And one of the great advantages of starting off with potentially very violent adolescence was that that break of the therapeutic container did happen quite frequently. So I got used to it. And then
in terms of action, you mean?
Oh, action, certainly. Adolescents would refuse to work with their counselor, for instance, or the counselors would find themselves feeling unable to work with the adolescent. There would be a breakdown of the arrangement. At that point, it became absolutely clear that what was necessary was that there should be the provision of what I boringly call the secondary container, which provides, first of all, it's known to both parties. The patient knows, for instance, if you put it back into the context of psychoanalysis, that you are a member of an association, and if they really want to, they can complain to the association about your behavior. So there's a containment just in that. And we, as therapists, are contained by something more than that. It's the opportunity for supervision and for clinical discussion. And so in the moment when a container breaks, the therapeutic container, it then, if there is an actual secondary container functioning in a cohesive way, it becomes possible to then try and hold together on behalf of the work, patient and therapist.
I want to emphasize what you're bringing up, because it isn't often spoken of. That is, that we all have inside us, both intrapsychically and actually in the real world, an outside container that we live in, whether it be our institute, whether it be the medical society that we belong to or the psychological society, some larger sense in addition to the one-on-one behavior. I discovered this some years ago. I had an experience many years ago of being ill and being out of the office for some time, and I wrote about the experience. And the focus of my, and at the time, many other people who wrote about it, was on what do you tell the patient about what happened to you, in what kind of detail, how self-revealing do you get? And in one of the things I wrote, I go to great length to try to parse that out oh so carefully, perhaps like you're deciding on the age of smoking. Yes. And then I realized, and I wrote about this, that the issue isn't really what do you tell your patients or what don't you tell your patients. That's sort of a fun topic, and it's manifest. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a screen image. It draws a lot of attention, but doesn't really reveal an underlying truth. And that for mm-hmm. me, the underlying truth was not what you tell your patient, but what do you tell your colleagues? Because, and that refers to the secondary container you're describing. That is, do you experience your colleagues as reparative colleagues, if you will, to borrow the phrase, or persecutory? And then apart from your experience, do they really evidence capacities of being reparative or persecutory? And that does make its way into our offices and certainly into our minds. And I think that's similar to how contained we are in our work.
I absolutely agree with you about that. And I think that the attention to the provision of the secondary container is very important. And I think one of the reasons why the quote that you made was from the ethics chapter. And one of the things I'm saying about ethics is that I don't know whether it's true in the States, but certainly in this country and in Europe, our registering bodies, our institutional homes, have become caught up in an idea that belongs to other professions of running an ethics system as if things are simply black and white. And so the only thing that matters if there's a complaint is to decide, did the therapist do it or not? And that approach, which is very paranoid schizoid, I think it makes a very uncomfortable home for the therapist to live in. And that's the point you were making. What kind of home have you got to live in?
Yes.
And if you design a home that is not there to as a refuge, but there as a place to be able to think, It's a slightly different concept. Sure. I'm not going to hide you in this secondary container, but I am going to help you to think in this secondary container. Then I think it feels easier to turn to colleagues and be open to them and get help. Whereas if you think that colleagues are going to be making judgments about you in this more paranoid, schizoid way, then it's not a safe place to go. And then you become stuck. And I think you probably become stuck doing things that otherwise you would not have done. You would be you, in your work, you will become more, you will get stuck in a particular line. You won't be able to move to a third position from which to think about what's going on. And you can see this happening in organizations like day hospitals and wards and residential therapeutic communities and so on. If the community becomes very rigid, then the quality of work goes down dramatically. And now I'm speaking from my position as an organizational consultant, very often going into places that where there's serious problems. And that relationship between the rigidity of the containing system and the poor practice is very, very clear. Equally, it's not difficult to cure. And the cures... You know what I'm going to say, don't you? The cure is to make managers to start off with and then the teams themselves become curious about it. Reinject curiosity and interest and things start to become alive again.
Well, yes, I thought you were going to say that, but there's what you're saying is far richer than just the word. I mean, what you're saying to invite them to become curious is to invite them to be able to tolerate affect. Yeah. To sit with notions of transgression as opposed to, as you say, the binary position, to be aware of their own projective needs to find badness outside rather than tolerate it inside. I mean, there's a whole world you're describing in that.
That's exactly right, yes. And it's, I just again, reminded, because that sounds as if it could be a sort of challenging thing to suggest that. And I just wanted to say when that first happened to me and how it wasn't challenging at all. It was quite the opposite. And that was when I went off to do the organizational consultancy training while I was this young manager of this therapeutic unit. Somebody, thank God, I mean, isn't it wonderful how people just come into your life and say things just as you need them?
Yes, it is.
Somebody said to me, don't go off and do another training. The training for you to do right now, Philip, is organizational consultancy so you can understand the psychoanalytic approach to thinking about organizations. And it was so brilliant. And I went off there. And at this stage, I was hating my work because I felt overwhelmed with anxiety, with feelings of inadequacy, hopelessness in the face of the challenges, immaturity. I was only 28, whatever it was, all kinds of feelings like that. I arrived for the training, and one of the first things we did was to talk to each other. We each took it in turns to say something about our work. And I don't think I was quite sobbing because at that stage I hadn't really allowed myself ever to learn how to sob. But I was sort of confessing that I was an idiot and hopeless and I couldn't do anything and I was having all of these feelings that proved it. And then they said to me, but Philip, don't you realize these are the feelings that those kids have that are being projected through the staff into you? And oh my God, it was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was
one of those moments, yeah.
Oh, it was wonderful. Because what I discovered in that second was that all of this pain, you know, the thing about the feeling awkward about transgression or the thing about feeling, all of that stuff suddenly became information instead of persecutory anxiety. And the information was about the patients and then about my way of responding to the patients and enabled me to be able to feel much safer about my practice.
How special.
Yeah.
Philip, you've given us bits and pieces of your journey. Tell us more about it. I mean, how do you find yourself where you are? You're challenging certain notions that some are comfortable with. You bring both an individual intrapsychic attunement, and at the same time, you're organizationally or focused, seeing the larger group. Tell us a little bit about your past and how this came to be.
How did it get here? Yeah. Okay. So I was the older of two children, two boys. My younger brother was only 15 months younger than me. We were very close, but he was ill. And in fact, it was difficult to understand what the illness was. It was clear to see what was happening because his spine was gradually bending over and crushing his lungs as he was growing. And at some point, I think when he was about five or six, some locum doctor noticed this and said, this has to be investigated. And so he began then a lifetime of going into hospital and spending most of his time in hospital being treated. My father was in the Navy and was at sea at this point. And so I became, as I saw it, the man of the family. And I became very helpful to my mother, who had to find a way of coping with looking after David, my brother. And that involved me sometimes traveling with her up to, because the hospital that was the specialist hospital for his kind of condition was about 100 miles away. And she had to drive up there and drive back. And I used to sometimes go with her, but other times when I was at school, I would come back and look after myself. And although I was quite frightened because I was quite young, nevertheless, you know, I was a man of the family. I was doing this. And then at about the age of 11, my father came back from his voyages, and I found myself suddenly in boarding school. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't understand what had happened. It felt to me as if I was being got rid of. I was absolutely certain that they were moving me out of the way so that they could focus on him. And I didn't actually feel bad about that in terms of jealous of him or anything. What I felt bad about was that they said that wasn't true. They said, we are sending you to boarding school because everybody says boarding school is the best education you can have. And I thought, this is just not true. And I went and tried to talk to people about it. I talked to the chaplain, who was as bad as much use as chaplains can often be. And then the extraordinary thing, the absolutely amazing thing, in a prep school, that is a school for boys up to 13, in the library was the psychopathology of everyday life. I mean, if, you know, I was 11, the only book you could possibly read by Freud that you could understand at that age is that book. And in it, I remember so well reading this bit, which we know is about Jung and him going to the States, but he describes coming to breakfast and seeing Jung's coat on his chair and realizing that he was being told, you can't sit here. And I thought, thank God, I'm right. There is this thing that goes on that people deny, but it really happens.
And someone understands me. Yeah.
Somebody understands me. And so that started me on this sort of journey of pursuing and also standing against. I mean, it's interesting that you say I do stand against things. I mean, I stood from there on, I was already standing against people saying, no, you're wrong. So that's it. I mean, you know, I could go on, but.
You know, you describe how fortunate it is when people come along and say just the right thing at the right moment, and you describe the Freud moment. That's sort of what I said when I described to you my experience in reading that chapter. It's not that the ideas weren't floating around in my mind and haven't been things that I and others have thought about and written about. But it was just one of those things. You had the same reaction when I read it. I said, wow, that's spot on, as you Brits might say. That really captures it. And And one of my reactions was, gee, I'd like to meet the man who wrote that. And I'd like to have a conversation with him. And I have. And I thank you for that. And I hope our listeners take as much pleasure from learning from you and hearing the way your mind works, really. That's really what your gift is. It isn't this idea or that idea. It's the fluidity of your mind. Mm-hmm. And I do recommend the book, again, The Curiosity Drive, Our Need for Inquisitive Thinking. I'm not here to sell the book, but there really are many sources of pleasure in it for those who like to dive deep into this. Philip, thank you for spending time. Thank you for sharing this. And it's been a pleasure to get to know you.
Harvey, you're very kind, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and it's a privilege to be on your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.